So, last time, yesterday we landed, well, we postulated the Parr-Taylor formula, much in the way they did. They did few cases and then they postulated that in general, for any number of particles interacting, so long as you have most of them having positive helicity and two of them with negative helicity, then the formula looks fairly simple. So there is something important that I didn't mention last time, which is that we're using the convention where all particles are incoming. So it looks a little bit unphysical to have all particles incoming, but the reason we do it is that there is a phenomenon in quantum field theory called crossing, which you probably have seen, or I hope, in quantum field theory, which tells you that from the same analytic object, you can construct many different processes that correspond to physical amplitudes. So from the same object, you can analytically continue to a region where particles 1 and 2 are incoming and the rest are outgoing, or where particles 3 and 4 are incoming and the rest are outgoing. So it's more convenient to work with a single object where everybody is incoming, and then, or we assume everybody, all the quantum numbers are determined assuming that the particles are incoming. Of course, momentum conservation will tell you that that's impossible, right? But we're not committing to any choice from the beginning. So we had momentum conservation. Every gluon came with three pieces of data, momentum, polarization, and the color index. We discovered that we can replace the first two by giving a pair of spinners for each particle, a number that is plus minus 1, which is called the helicity, and we still keep the color structure or the color index of the gluon. But in the first lecture, we were able to extract all that information and put it in terms of traces, and this is the kinematic part, or at least that's a conjecture. Okay. The relation between momenta and the spinners is given here. We also discovered these Lorentz invariant inner products for the spinners of positive chirality and negative chirality. And we also wrote down the three particle amplitudes. In the tutorial today, so we use a trick to find these guys. And in the tutorial today, you will check that this formula is correct. And if you have time, I encourage you to check the other ones as well. Except that you're going to find that if you were working just in Young Mills, meaning that you have this Lagrangian, you will find that these two, in this theory, these two are not present. Only these two will be present. So if these amplitudes, we can write them down, but they are not in Young Mills, in this Lagrangian, what are the amplitudes of? So try to think about that. And if you don't know the answer, you can ask Barbara, or you can ask some people here. Yep. Lucia, or Jaime. Jaime, right? Ah. OK. And somebody else who is not here. I should remember the names. I have it. Who is?
Leon.
Yes. Okay, fine. In principle, you all know the answer because you went to the winter school and they gave a nice presentation about it. But if you don't remember, you can ask them. But try to think about it. Okay, so given that this formula is so important, let's start the lecture by trying to prove it. In order to prove it, we're going to use a trick, which is just simple complex analysis. So what's the complex analysis we're going to use? So imagine, just a warm-up, imagine you're given the following data. You're asked to construct a function f of z. And you're told that this function is a function of a complex variable z, is a rational function, a rational function is defined as a function that is the ratio of two polynomials. Okay, that's the name, that's why you call it rational function. And you're given the following data, such that first, it has only simple poles at zi, at z equals to zi, where I goes from a range from 1 to m, say. Second, it has residues equal to Ri at Ci. So it has simple poles, so it also has residues, but you're also told what the residues are. And third, you're also told that the function f of z vanishes when z goes to infinity. Well, I'm sure you can all write down what this function is right away. But if you want to be fancy and you want to show off a little bit, you can say, well, imagine that I didn't know how to write this function. So one way to do it would be to say, well, let me use the following identity. Let me write down this function as follows. This is just a trivial identity. So I have on the complex plane W, I have a point z. I'm performing this integral around z. Of course, assuming that I'm not sitting at any pole of the function f of w, this is a simple pole, so I can get this answer right away, right? So this is an identity. Okay, how can this possibly help me? Well, it's going to help me because it's a nice way of constructing objects where you know the analytic data in terms of the structure, the structure of the singularities and what happens at the singularity. This is actually a nice trick, even if you're given, say, a function that is not even a rational function. It could have branch cuts. And they tell you that this function has a branch cut, and you know what happens when you cross the branch cut. Even in those cases, this trick is useful. And you're going to see why, because now we're going to say, well, this is a trivial identity. But what if I use the residue theorem, and I deform this contour to move this contour out and enclose any other singularity that my function can have? Could it be poles? It could be branch cuts. It could be anything that you want. In this case, we are told that there is only something interesting happening at a finite number of points. So when I deform this contour out, the residue theorem guarantees that that integral is the same as minus the sum from 1 to m of the integral of the same thing. So I'm not doing anything to the integrand. I'm just deforming the contour. But now I have little circles enclosing the other singularity. In principle, there would also be a term very, very far away at infinity . But would we get any contribution from there? Well, let's check. F of z, or f of w, we are told it vanishes as w goes to infinity. But we also have 1 over w here. So this function altogether at least goes like 1 over w squared. And would that give a contribution around infinity or not? No. So that's not a pole at infinity. So this actually gives 0. That's why the third condition is important. But now we are done, because those integrals are very easy to do if you are told what the residues are. So f of z is nothing but the sum from I equals to 1 to m of Ri over Zi minus Z. We're evaluating omega at the value of the residue, at the location of the pole, and this is what we get. Now you see why the minus sign was important. The residue theorem told us that we were integrating clockwise, and now to get the integration clockwise again, we had to put a minus sign. And this is what you could have written from the very start. If you are told to write down a function that has poles at some locations, you will write down something that looks like this sum, and they tell you that the residues are Ri, you will have written this down. So it was a fancy way of getting something very simple. The reason I decided to show it to you like this is because, again, if you're doing more complicated functions that have branch cuts, this would also work. If there was a branch cut somewhere, once you deform this contour, you will pick the poles, but the contour will hug the branch cut. And as it hugs the branch cut, you go along the branch cut in one direction and come back in the other direction. And as you push this to hug very, very closely the branch cut, what you find is the difference between the value of the function on one side of the branch cut and the value of the function on the other side of the branch cut. And that's what is called the discontinuity across the branch cut. And if you're given that data, you can construct your function as well. OK, so now let's apply this to our amplitudes. And in order to do that, we have to find this complex variable z. How do we find it? Well, that's what we did in something called BCFW. So we did it in collaboration with Brito, Feng, and Witten in 2005. So what was found is that there is a natural way of taking an amplitude. So this time, we're going to take a partial amplitude, let's say a piece like this. Remember, we're supposed to prove this, so we don't know what it looks like. So we take a partial amplitude, and we want to build a function of a single complex variable. So the way to do it is the following. So let's choose two particles, and let's write down explicitly their spinners. So we want to perform a deformation that allows us to stay or to keep this amplitude as an amplitude. In other words, we want to introduce a complex variable so that this is still an amplitude. It still satisfies momentum conservation because this is always there. If we violate this, we're going to get zero because it's multiplied by that. So one way of doing it would be to deform just the spinners. By deforming the spinners, we guarantee that the particles are still massless. And we have to ensure that we have momentum conservation. So here is one way of doing it. There are many, many ways of doing it. So let's promote this to be a function of z by doing the following. We take the original object, and we deform it by the lambda tilde of the other particle that we chose to be special. Why do we do that? Because if we now deform the lambda of this particle in this way, the new set of data, once we write momentum conservation in spinner variables, which we can do here, let's write it like this, 2 times 2. Any ideas why I'm writing this as 2 times 2 and not 4? Well, I'm going to write it, and then you can tell me. Well, here the 4 tells us that this mu index takes 4 values. And here the 2 times 2 is telling us that the 2 indices alpha and alpha dot take 2 values. So we have also 4 delta functions, but they come from this index. Here we have 4 delta functions, but they come from the vector index. Now, this is just a way of reminding us that this is slightly different from this because we're making this transformation. But now if you use this, we can check. So you can easily check. This is not even an exercise because we can do it. We can see it explicitly. If you have this piece in momentum conservation that depends on Z, this is one of the terms. There are many other terms, but then there is also the nth term. Now you can see what happens when I perform, when I write down that explicitly here, I get the original momentum for particle 1 plus Z times lambda of particle 1, lambda tilde of particle n. And from here, I get the original guy for particle n, the original momentum for particle n, minus, and that's the reason for the minus, the same thing that I had there. So these two pieces cancel out, and I'm still satisfying momentum conservation for any value of z. No matter what you choose, momentum conservation is satisfied. So this is going to be our function f of z. What else do you need to construct it? You have to know where the poles are and what the residues are. And then you have to know whether the object vanishes at infinity or not. So let's start first with location of the poles, or the pole structure. Well, here we rely again on Feynman diagrams for a change. So this object is built out of Feynman diagrams. Where could the poles come from as a function of z? What do you think? They can only come in Feynman diagrams. Where can we get singularity? As we make this substitution of momenta that depend on z, the only singularities in a Feynman diagram are the propagators. So the only singularities that we can have are the propagators in our theory that look like this. Okay. Where P is the sum of some collection of momenta. So imagine that we separate momenta particles. So there are Feynman diagrams where we have this propagator, and some particles are on the left and some particles are on the right of that particular propagator. Okay. What's the condition we need for that propagator to depend on Z? Well, you see, if particle 1 and n are on the same side, the propagator, which is the sum of all the momenta of the particles on that section, will not depend on Z. Or by momentum conservation, we could write this as particles, the sum of momenta of particles on the right. And therefore, if 1 and n were on this side, none of these guys will depend on Z. So in order to get a chance of having a pole, of having a propagator that depends on Z, we have to split up 1 and n. 1 has to be on one side, and n has to be on the other side. Remember, I'm not doing anything to the rest. Nobody else knows about Z. So that means that we need particle 1 to be on this side. Any collection of particles could be on this side. And here is where the magic of dealing with partial amplitudes is. Can we have any collection of particles here? Or are we restricted to have some particular collection of particles on this side? So remember that now the only Feynman diagrams that contribute to this partial amplitude are the planar Feynman diagrams, the ones that are consistent with the ordering 1, 2 through n So it's impossible for me to put particle m minus 1 on this side if I already put particle 1 here and particle n here, because I'm supposed to respect the planar ordering given by the partial amplitude that I'm computing. So the first major simplification happens. We can restrict the number of terms that we have to use or that we have to compute dramatically because we have the color ordering. So from having a quadratic number of terms with all possible combinations, we are now having just a linear number of terms because we can only go from 2. So this I can only go from 2 to n minus 2. But we're going to discuss that in part 2. So let's, for the time being, say that we have a propagator, or let's call the propagator pi, is given by the sum of all particles from 1 to I of ki. Now we perform the deformation, and the deformation only happens in particle 1. And we know that the deformation happens as follows. Particle 1 depends on z as its momentum undeformed plus z times this object. But let's give a name to that object. Let's call it q mu, so that we don't have to write these indices all over and over again. So this is this plus z q mu. So what is the pole? The pole is 1 over p squared of z. That's the structure of the pole. And that means that the location is where p squared of z is equal to 0. Now we can compute p squared of z. This is p undeformed. So we get p I squared undeformed plus 2 times p I times q times z plus q squared z squared equal to 0. But what is q squared? Q is a product of two spinors. So Q squared, so Q is a null vector, and Q squared is 0. That's great, because then we don't have to solve a quadratic equation. So Q squared is equal to 0, because it's a null vector. And that means that the location of the pole Zi, which is where this is equal to 0, is minus Pi squared over 2 times pi dot q. Now we have the first piece of data that we needed, the location of the poles. Let's move on. Let's use this one. To the residues. Okay. So what happens to our amplitude? We know it's a sum of Feynman diagrams. And the only Feynman diagrams that will diverge that can give us a residue when zi, when z becomes equal to zi, are Feynman diagrams that look like this. They have a piece on the left and a piece on the right. But all the diagrams that have a piece on the left will build up something that combinatorially has the same structure as the Feynman diagrams that you need to construct an amplitude on the left. So this picture is not just an accident. It's actually all the combinatorial Feynman diagrams that you need to construct this amplitude. And why generally this is not an amplitude? Because this particle is not really a particle. When we are drawing Feynman diagrams, this object is off-shell. The object cannot be interpreted as a particle. But at the location of the pole, where was the value of this momentum at the location of the pole? The value of this momentum is pi evaluated at zi. But this object, by definition, is a null vector. That means that we can treat it as a physical particle. After all, it's null. And these objects will satisfy momentum conservation because this guy was equal to the sum of these ones. Now, how is that possible? Well, it's possible because these two particles were deformed, particle 1 and n. But once this particle is on shell, the part of the propagator that we have here can be written in a nice way. We can write it as the sum of all possible polarizations for a particle with this momentum, because after all, this is a physical particle now. So we have to sum over all possible physical polarizations of that particle. So let me write the indices down, because it's a little easier. Associated with this momenta, which I'm going to call p hat I, to make it easier to write here. So it's a null vector, so we can associate a polarization vector to it. I'm sure you have seen this formula. But of course, these two guys, these two terms, don't generate the full four-dimensional space. So we also have to add other terms that look like this, times something, let's call it q. We need a four-dimensional basis. This is our four-dimensional basis. But what happens when these pieces hit the amplitudes on the left and on the right? So we are contracting this index pi on this side. So it's as if we are taking one of the particles to have a polarization vector which is longitudinal. So what are we supposed to get? Any physical amplitude, if we're doing the calculation correctly, what does it give you when you replace the polarization vector of one of the particles by its corresponding momentum? Zero. So these two guys, once you put them in here, they will not contribute, so we can forget about them. Only these two will contribute. And once they do, this thing will connect to this object to give us a physical amplitude. So this object will be a nice amplitude with some helicity h. And on the other side, we will have another physical amplitude with some helicity minus h. So the product of these two physical amplitudes, which now we're going to assume you know, because we're building recursion relations. So we are building something bigger from a smaller object. So you are supposed to know these smaller objects, so you can multiply them. But this is not quite the full residue, because the propagator looks a little bit complicated. It's actually this full object. So the propagator looks like 1 over pi squared plus z q dot pi. So the residue will also have this piece, right? Because we have to write it like what we have there, z minus something, to pull out the residue. So this thing will be this times 1 over 2q dot pi. And this thing are our residues. We're summing over the possible values of the helicity. Now, part three, we will just assume. It can actually be proven. And the proof is actually surprisingly simple. But I think we can just leave it for the, say, for the homework. Or that would be a nice little exercise. It's actually surprisingly simple. How is possible that this works? Now assume it, but it's only true, or is easily proven, if the helicity of particle 1 is minus 1 and the helicity of particle n is plus 1. Why do you think this thing has to do with the helicity of the particles? Well, if you look in your notes, look at the polarization vector. If you look at the formula of the polarization vectors and you see how this deformation acts on the polarization vectors, you will see that the choice of the helicity and the choice of the deformations are tailor-made to each other so that the polarization vectors will try to kill the amplitude at infinity. So they are actually going to be your friends. If you mess up, they are going to make your life complicated, and condition three will not be satisfied if you switch these two conditions. It turns out that it's also true if you have plus plus or minus minus, but the proof is not going to be that simple. Okay, so the one you're going to do in your homework is this one, which is fairly simple. Okay, so now we're done. What's our function of z? The amplitude is, again, the sum over I from 2 to m minus 2. The reason I say 2 is that we need at least two particles here. So I can go from 2. If I is m minus 2, we're left with two particles on this side. Of what? Of the sum over the helicities. So we have this object here times this thing times, I'm just copying the answer that we got here, right? So this is the Ri times 1 over z minus zi. But zi was minus, I put a plus, pi squared over 2 q dot pi. And you see that I'm using just the formula that is written over there for f of z that is in the box. I'm just plugging in what ri's are, which are these objects, and multiply by the corresponding formula that gives the pole. And the amplitude is obtained by setting z to 0. So the physical amplitude. So we did all this deformation. But of course, if we set z to 0, we recover the object that we wanted. So this is obtained by setting z to 0. And when you set z to 0, this guy cancels this, and we just get a propagator. So the object, sometimes people draw it like this. So it's the sum from 2 to m minus 2 of the sum over helicities of this. And sometimes people put the propagator in between, n of zi, 1 of zi. This one is not evaluated at zi, right? If it was, it would be 0. This is the original propagator. OK, so let's use this to compute the four-particle amplitude and check the Part-Taylor formula. After all, we have the three-particle amplitudes written there, so we can easily do it. So let's do the four-particle amplitude. Know that this is the object that is supposed to give you 100 terms, right? So if we were doing it, so if we were using Feynman diagrams, I doubt that I could do it in 5 minutes, which is the time we have for that, for this calculation. So let's see how long it takes if we do it using what we just derived. So what are we supposed to do? Well, we are supposed to deform 1 and 4. And the answer is supposed to be the sum over all possibilities from I equals to 2 to m minus 2. But it so happens that m minus 2 is also 2. So we have only one term, right? So in the sum, we only have one term. So we are supposed to go from 1 to 2, sum over the helicities of this particle. So let me write it as h minus h. We have 3. And 4, these ones are supposed to be deformed and evaluated at the location of the pole. But how many poles we have? We have only one pole. So let's not even call it, let's call it star, because we only have one pole. Times 1 over the propagator. But the propagator is the sum of these two momenta going into there. So it's k3 plus k4 squared. Okay, that looks pretty good. Now, look at the table of three particle amplitudes. If the helicity is minus one, we get the amplitudes that are not in Jangmyeons. So if we put them in, we will compute the amplitudes of something, but that something is not Jangmyeons. So h equals to minus one is not Jangmyeons. So it's not present in Jangmyeons. By that I mean that if you try to compute those guys with those helicities in Jangmyeons theory, you will get zero. So we get zero for that. So we only have to worry about h equals to plus one. So let me erase that directly here. So we don't have a sum because we're only doing Jangmyeons. In just standard Jangmyeons theory, this is all we have. But now we can use the formulas. So what is this? The first amplitude is 1, 2 cube over 1 I 2. But now you would say, wait a minute, particle 1 is deformed. But look at the deformation. Who is deformed? The lambda or the lambda tilde? If you see in the top board here, the lambda tilde is the one that we deformed. We didn't do anything to lambda 1. We made a deformation to lambda 1 tilde, not to lambda 1. So the one that appears here very nicely is the undeformed one. So we can just write it very easily. Now, how about pi? Pi, this internal momentum, is a null vector. So it has some decomposition. Should we go ahead and find what this thing is and so on? We could, but we don't have to. You will see why. So we have this. This is the first piece times the second amplitude. Now look at the table here. The second amplitude is 3, 4 square, 3i, i4, times this, the propagator. But we know how to write this in our fancy notation now. This is just 3, 4, 3, 4. This is undeformed. Remember, these are the original momenta. There is no z dependence here, otherwise we will get zero. So this is the guy that we got from the last part of the formula. This guy is the one that enters here. Okay? So we see a very nice simplification. This guy cancels things. Okay, so we still have a long way to go to get something that looks like the Part-Taylor formula. But let's regroup these things in a nicer way. So let's do 1, 2 cube, 3, 4. Let me group it like this. 1i. I'll put this guy together with this guy. What happens if I flip the order of one of these brackets? 3, 1, and 1. 3i and i1. What do I get? A minus sign. But I'm not going to worry because I'm also going to do it again. So I'm going to write 2i by flipping this one. And I'm going to put it together with this guy. And by together, I mean that I'm going to compute them in one shot. So let's do the first one. So I'm going to write these brackets explicitly, just to see what they look like. So this is the first bracket, and this is the second bracket. You see what I'm doing? I just wrote down explicitly what this was. one i, and then i3. And now I'm going to look at this guy and realize that this object is nothing but this momentum. But this momentum is equal to what? It's equal to the momentum for particle 3, say my guy 3 here, plus, well, in this particular case, I'm going to write it like this. I'm going to use that it's the sum of these two momentum. Actually, it doesn't matter. No, I'm gonna I'm going to do it like that, with 3. 3 alpha alpha dot plus k 4 alpha alpha dot. But there is a deformation of the lambda of this particle, which produces a z lambda 1 alpha lambda tilde 4 alpha dot. So that's what this guy is evaluated at the special value where this guy becomes a null vector. Now you see, what happens if I plug this into here? What happens to the first term, the k3? I'm going to have a lambda 3, lambda 3 tilde, but there is also lambda 3 tilde here. It drops out. OK, so let me write explicitly here. We have k3 plus k4 minus z star lambda 1 lambda 4 tilde. This guy cancels out because we have a lambda 3 tilde that kills it. With a contraction with the antisymmetric tensor, we get 0. This guy is not killed by anyone. And this guy, what happens to this one? There is a lambda 1. Sorry, the notation is slightly inconsistent. What happens to lambda 1 is contracted with this lambda 1. So it's also killed. So this thing is nothing but I can replace this right away by particle 4, the lambda and the lambda tilde of particle 4. So I get 1, 4, 4, 3. Likewise, we can do the same trick to this one. So this is what this becomes. And the same trick to this one to give us 2, 3, 3, 4. Now you put it together. Sorry, this was a cube. Right? If you look at the formulas, it's a cube. And this guy made it into a square. So I was jumping one step ahead of myself. So this guy is a square. And let's collect what we have in the denominator. We have 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 1. And these two guys give us 3, 4 squared, which cancel these things. And this is a Part-Taylor formula for 4 particles. Let's check. All right. Very good. All right, any questions about this? Because now we're going to introduce a different trick.
Where did the third power of 3, 4 on the bottom come from?
Which power?
3, 4 in the angular bracket.
This one here? No.
In the final thing you wrote down, 3, 4 in angular brackets?
This one?
No, in the angular bracket.
Oh, the angular bracket. This 3, 4?
Oh, okay.
All right.
Where do the, and the A's stop?
Oh, yes.
Do you see the bracket, the 2qpi and the z plus pi squared?
Where did it come from?
The below. In
this one?
Yeah, where do they go in?
Oh, they cancel this guy. Because I set z equal to 0.
OK.
This cancels. Oh, these are all great questions. This means that you really follow the thing. That's great. I mean, these are very detailed questions. So that's very, very good. OK. But now, in order to see the genius of Witten, at least a small part of it, we have to introduce another trick to rewrite the Part-Taylor formula in a slightly better way. So this idea of having I and j, you see that the dependence on I and j is just very mild. It's just in that numerator. So we want to construct a generating function. And this generating function was already written down by Nayer. As I told you, this was already in 1988. So what is the idea? The idea is something that you all have seen. We want to take this guy. This guy is a determinant. So the trick is to write the determinant as an integral over Grassmann variables. So you have done that in order to discuss fermions in quantum field theory. But here, we're just going to use it as a trick. So how are we going to write this? Well, we introduce Grassmann variables for the row space and Grassmann variables for the column space. So the ones for the row space, let me call them like this, and the ones for the for the column space, I'm going to use a strange notation, but it's going to be, you're going to see why. It's just notation at this point. Now we're going to do something that always looks unnecessary, no matter how many times you do it. So this is what we do. If you want to compute the determinant of a matrix, this is just the entries of your matrix, right? With indices A and B, one set of Grassmann variables hit this, the label A, and the other set hits the label B. And what I'm doing here is writing down every possible term. So say now we have theta 2, lambda I, 2, eta I, plus theta 1, lambda J, eta tilde J, 1, plus one more term, which I'm going to write. So there is only one term left. So these are Grassmann variables. So you know this is equal to 0. All these guys are equal to 0. They anti-commute. So you can expand this exponential. You're not going to get only a finite number of terms. And then you can use the rules for integration of Grassmann numbers. Knock yourself out and get, after a long calculation, you get this determinant. OK. So we better get something nice after all this completely complicated reformulation of something as simple as that. So now what do? We take this guy, and we perform the theta integrations. Well, this is also going to sound a little silly. We have e to the theta times something. Let's call it chi. Well, this object, I'm going to say that it looks like a Fourier transform of a delta function. So I'm just going to denote it as this. But if you did the calculation explicitly, what would the answer be? You have to expand the exponential. You get 1 plus theta times chi. The 1 gives you 0. The theta times chi term gives you chi. Do you agree? But do we have the right to call chi delta of chi? Well, don't we call a delta function anything that gives you 1 once you integrate over the whole space? We do, right? But that's what chi does. So delta of chi is chi. Or in other words, chi could also be thought of as delta, as the Dirac delta function of chi, because it satisfies this condition from here. OK, all that to say that we can do the theta integrations. So let's do the integration over theta 1. What do we get? We get delta of lambda 1 I eta tilde I plus lambda 1 J eta tilde J. This is the integration over theta 1. Integration over theta 2 gives you J eta J. Sorry, the same thing, but with 2 here. So kind of nice to, oh, but then I forgot, we only did the integrations over theta. We still have the integrations over the eta's. Okay. So let me write this as a delta function over 2 with two delta functions, because I'm going to write the index alpha explicitly. And the 2 is simply telling me that I have two delta functions, one for each value that the index alpha can possibly take. OK. Now, what we have in the formula, in the Part-Taylor formula, is four powers of that thing. So that 4 has always been very suspicious. Why 4? And not 8, say. So if you have 4 powers of the determinant, what you can do is to introduce 4 copies of each of the Grassmann variables. So let's introduce an index I that goes from 2 to 4, from 1 to 4. And we have 4 of them for each particle. And therefore, this can be written as an integral over all 4 of these things. Of delta 2 times 4 this time of lambda I alpha eta I with the index I plus the same thing for j. All right? Now here comes the way of producing the generating function. So instead of writing something that depends on the particles I and j, what we can do is to write down a nicer formula, which looks like this. We're going to write down a formula that depends on the lambdas of the particles, the lambda tildes of the particles. And now it's also going to depend on these new eta variables. These are like the variable, like the auxiliary variables that you introduce when you are describing the generating function of Hermite polynomials or Legendre polynomials. If you remember, you have a collection of objects that depend on some variable, I don't know, t, and you want to put them together into a function that generates them. So you introduce another variable called z, and you write this Rodriguez formula or something that contains two variables. And as you expand out, you pull out the coefficients, and the coefficients are the objects that you're interested in. So this object, these etas, are playing the role of that auxiliary variable. And the object that I'm going to write here will contain, as coefficients of these etas, all possible Part-Taylor amplitudes. This blackboard is not, this one is, there are some blackboards that are nicer than others, right? So this one, very hard to get the chalk to stick to it. So this is momentum conservation. So look at the Part-Taylor formula over there. And now what we're going to do is to say, well, if you take this same thing, but we sum over all particles, every time you're interested in the ij1, you just simply integrate over these guys and set the other ones to 0. And you get the factor that you want. So what we're going to have here is something of the form 2 times 4 sum over lambda I eta tilde I with a corresponding index. Divided by 1, 2, yeah, this is incredible. I don't know. 1, 2, 2, 3. Well, good thing we wrote it over there. N1. Now you see why I introduced this notation for the eta tildes. Because now the formula looks as if the eta tildes had something to do with the lambda tildes. They are kind of partners to the lambda tilde. Which reminds me that now, so let's write here that this is our formula. And let's write here that the etas, remind ourselves that the etas go from 1 to 4. Now, this formula also has another secret inside, which is that as you expand this in all possible and collect all possible terms, as you expand this formula, you will find, of course, things that look like 1, 2 squared. Sorry, 1, 2 to the 4th, 3, 1 to the 4th. These are the ones that we've built, right? But what else could you find? You will also find things that look like this. 1, 2, 3, 4 cubed. There will also be pieces that look like this. 1, 3 square, 4, 5 square, and so on. So these pieces will have different helicities than minus 1. That's very strange. So it's as if this formula also contained not only the scattering of a bunch of plus helicity particles and minus helicity particles, which we knew already because we built it to have helicities with value minus 1 and plus 1. If you remember the definition of the helicity and the rescaling that we defined yesterday, by counting the powers that you have of lambdas, you can determine the helicities of the particles. And these other objects will give you all possible values that you have here, jumping by halves. Because every time something appears or doesn't appear, removes exactly half of the helicity. So you can go from here or increase the helicity to minus a half, zero, half, and one. Now, this helicity minus 1 and plus 1, these are our gluons. But what are these guys? These guys are fermions. And these guys have helicity 0, and that's what we call a scalar particle. How many of them we have here? So you see that there is only one way of getting this. So this is a number of ways of getting this formula. There is only one way of getting this for a given particle. There is only one combination of indices that will give us this particle. We have to put all four etas together to get this. To get this one, we don't put any etas. To get this one, you can choose four possible values of etas and get a minus helicity, minus half helicity particle. So we have four possibilities for this guy. Also four for this guy. And to get something that has helicity 0, you have to choose two values of this set of four. So 4 choose 2 is 6. So you have 6 different ways to get a scalar for a given particle, to turn a given particle into a scalar. And now you see, this guy is a vector boson. This guy is a scalar. This is a boson. And this guy is our vector boson. These guys are fermions. And if you do this boson minus fermion plus boson minus fermion, what do you get? So 1 minus 4 plus 6 minus 4 plus 1 happens to be 0. So we have the same number of fermionic degrees of freedom. So the number of fermions equals the number of bosons. And this means that this theory, or this amplitude, is the amplitude for a theory that has supersymmetry, but not any supersymmetry. In fact, the 4 that appears in the formula, in the Part-Taylor formula, which is actually used for accelerators, as we started the whole lecture, that 4 means that this theory has what is called 4 supersymmetries, and it's nothing but the famous n equals 4 super Young Mills. So somehow, the scattering of gluons that we use in accelerators at 3 level, they somehow believe that they are part of a supersymmetric theory for some weird reason. So this is a formula that we're going to take tomorrow. And written in this form, all it takes is a genius, but then, and 5 minutes. So to generalize this to all the other sectors or all other possible helicity configurations that we didn't write down. In particular, as we said, the Part-Taylor formula works beautifully when you have 2 minus helicity particles and the rest plus. But the moment you change another helicity to be minus, you get in deep trouble. The formulas explode, and they become very, very complicated. So today, we have seen that I've given you, with the BCFW recursion relations, you can calculate those objects, and they become way simpler than the expression with Feynman diagrams. So that's a very efficient way of calculating any amplitude, not only the Part-Taylor formula, but any other amplitudes. But tomorrow, we're going to see how to translate this formula into something that looks pretty much like this, again. But it will compute every single possibility that you can imagine for the possible helicities of the particle. Okay, and that's going to be the Witten string twister string formula, right? So I'll see you tomorrow, unless you have any questions now.